I'm Jeff Childers, and wow, I'm surprised so many people came to a class the title of which they could not pronounce. I had a lot of people come up to me and say, "What is that? What is that about?" And because the word's kind of funny, but it was this is actually Mike Cope's idea. He said, "I'd like you to come teach about this topic." So, as you might guess, I'm something of a J.R.R. Tolkien fan. And so we've got, yeah, so the four of us are going to this time this morning. And I have been a fan since the fifth grade, which is actually quite a long time ago. Now, I'm not one of these weird kind of fanatical sort of people who might, you know, dress up like one of the characters. That's why I had kids. Yeah, and what's funny is for some of these kids, I mean, this is before the movies came out for some of these, and so that's just one of the reasons why they have name tags. People are going, "Well, who are you, and what is that? Why, you know, why? What has your dad done?" Now, some people have said that they believe it's possible. Please come on in. We've got some seats. There's one down here. There's one here in the middle. You might scoot in a little bit and let people. There are a couple back here. There are actually plenty of seats for most people. I was going to say everybody, but I don't know. I haven't counted them. There's one right down here at the front, sort of in the spit zone. Is that where you're at? So the fact is I'm a pretty serious fan of Tolkien's work. But I'm not the only one who is, right? Three or four of us here, but there are actually a lot of us here. I guess, I don't know, you wandered in thinking there was something else going on here. But Tolkien has been really popular over the last several decades, and of course since these movies came out, especially Wham! And that has been very annoying to the experts. Especially the literary experts and some other experts of culture. They're not convinced that a book like The Lord of the Rings is great literature for the 20th century, now for the 21st century. And just because Peter Jackson's films, The Lord of the Rings and The Hobbit, have grossed about $4 billion in global box office receipts alone, that is no guarantee that this is quality stuff. And I'll be the first to say that box office receipts aren't necessarily the best metric of quality, right? But even before these movies came out, the critics were shocked. Back in 1996, the Waterstones, which is this British bookstore, and BBC Channel 4 did this poll asking everybody, okay, what are the best books of the 20th century? And there were about 26,000 or so that responded to this poll. And in nearly every branch in the UK, The Lord of the Rings came in first. The book of the 20th century. Okay, that couldn't be right. So the Daily Telegraph did a poll, very different kind of audience, but they did a similar poll, and it came up with the same result. And then the Folio Society did a study. What are the books that you would most like to see brought out in a Folio Society edition? And then it came back with the same result. And it wasn't until 1999. Let's see, do we have... There's a seat maybe there, and... I think we're almost out of seats. But I don't have a seat. If anybody would like to join me up here walking around. It's very comfortable up here, except when I walk in front of the screen. So in 99, there was a Mori poll backed by the Nestle Corporation, and very rigorous. And finally, you know, much to everybody's relief, The Lord of the Rings was bumped from its number one spot and dropped down to number two. As, you know, the most important book of the 20th century, right behind the Bible. So, wow, we're getting amens about that up here. I like it. So this is how Tolkien gets this sort of informal title, the author of the century. And it's kind of funny, because unlike most of the other books that got ranked in those listings, this is not a book that many high school literature teachers have required their students to read. Also, when it came out, it wasn't even, it didn't even fit in a kind of genre or noticeable, you know, market niche or something. Now, of course, we think, oh, well, that's a, there's a whole bookstore section devoted to this book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, not when it came out. It sort of created this bookstore section, and it's just a remarkable phenomenon that would be so popular. So why are there so many literary experts and academics who are frustrated about the popularity of this story? Well, there's some different answers. The first answer is, and I'll let you in on a little secret about academics, because I know several. And sometimes they can be a little snobby about things that are popular, if you know what I mean. It's possible. I've seen that happen. But they did actually have reasons too. This story, you got to be kidding me. This is not a realistic story. This is not a modern story. And maybe worst of all, there's something about this story that's just too optimistic for the 20th century. You got this story about elves and dwarves and hobbits and this make-believe world. The 20th century is a grim and gritty time. And now the 21st century shows every sign of being, you know, just as much sort of characterized by the darkness of what's happening in our world. And meaningful stories today shouldn't just sort of gloss over that and escape from that by going off into some fantasy la-la land. What we need are stories that really present the ugliness of evil. Mm-hmm. Stories that will really take that on and make us sort of wrestle with that and think about the darkness of the world in which we live. Not just distracting you with sprites and fairies and magic lights and that sort of thing. And you would have thought that an author like J.R.R. Tolkien, who had been in World War I and had fought in France and seen the horrors of war, wouldn't be so naive about war and how that wars, even when you think you're, you know, fighting them for the best possible reasons, that they always seem to do more damage than they ever do good, and that there's a lot of trauma in the world because of that. And you got all these fantasy escapist stories that glamorize war and they're rah-rah about it. In the 20th century, and now in the 21st, we've learned to be very suspicious of these clear-cut good guys, bad guys kind of dichotomy. Because what we've learned is that what might seem very good could turn out to be not so good. And that some of the things that were plausible answers turn out not to be such great answers. And that even the most noble and heroic people might be corrupted, especially by power. And these escapist stories like The Lord of the Rings, they just have these shallow characters and never really wrestle with that. They think it's cut and dry. It's black hats, white hats. And of course, in those kind of simple escapist stories, the good guys always use power for good, and the bad characters always use power for bad. And it's too bad that in the 20th century, a story like The Lord of the Rings doesn't understand that what the modern world has come to realize is that, frankly, it doesn't matter who's using the power, it's probably a problem. That power is tricky, and power corrupts, and power, especially power over others, causes problems, and evil is complicated. And these silly escapist stories like The Lord of the Rings never really understand that. Besides which, who ever heard of a realistic happy ending anyway? You know, you've got these children's stories, fantasy stories, they're scary for a little while, but then at the end of it, everything turns out okay. And the good guys get what they want, and they get to go back home and live in peace and happily ever after. And that's not the real world. In the real world, there are always scars, and people get traumatized, and even a whole society, or maybe a whole natural environment that people live in, could carry the wounds of the conflicts. And it doesn't just end nice and bright and sunshiny. And even the very best endings often carry deep woundedness and some bitter sadness with them. If only a popular story like The Lord of the Rings could understand some of these complexities about the world in which we actually live. Okay, now, a lot of you, some of you I know, some of you I don't know, and I have a particular style of teaching. It's not a good one, but it's mine. And occasionally it uses irony. And I want to just kind of clarify the last few minutes. There's been a little bit of irony in what I've been saying. At least I've intended it to be so. Because this is a story, and I think this strikes at the heart of its popularity, actually. This is a story that actually deals with the real world issues and is not really so naive about them. And although I've tried to be subtle all this time, let me be blunt. I think it is realistic. And I think it is modern, hobbits or no hobbits. But I will give them this. I'll give the critics this. This story is optimistic. And I think that makes it... See? Modern. That makes it stand out a little bit from a prevailing mood today. But do hope and optimism have to be naive? Tolkien didn't think so. And many people today would like to believe that he's right. And it's no wonder that so many people are drawn to these stories today, because in a way, that fits the world in which we live, the real world in which we live, with all its complexities and problems and challenges and proposed solutions that seem not to work. This story is trying to tell one of the great stories.
I wonder if we'll ever be put into songs or tales.
What?
I wonder if people will ever say, let's hear about Frodo and the ring. And I'll say, yes, it's one of my favorite stories.
Frodo was really courageous, wasn't he, Dad?
Yes, my boy. The most famousest of hobbits. And that's saying a lot.
We've left out one of the chief characters.
Samwise the Brave.
I want to hear more about Sam.
Now, Mr. Frodo, you shouldn't make fun. I was being serious.
So was I.
So I'm going to be using, you've seen already, without paying off any of the, I'm sure, required royalties. stills, clips from the films. And that's because I think those are images that a lot of people are familiar with. Not everyone was tutored on, you know, these both canons of scripture, like my children were early on, and know the books as well. And so these images, I think, are pretty familiar. So Sam's going along, and he realizes that he's in a story, and it's not just any story. But as he thinks about it, it's one of the great stories. In fact, he becomes aware that he is in the great story, playing a role that started a long time before he ever showed up. And this comes from the book. Why to think of it, he says. We're in the same tale still. It's still going on. Don't the great tales never end? No, they never end as tales, said Frodo. But the people in them come and go when their part's ended. Our part will end later or sooner. Frodo's in one of his happy times. Yeah. This part of the story. We live in a world where there are a lot of stories. And you might say, that's the big question. What is the real story? What's the true story? What's the story that's going to work? What's the story that you live by? And people, I think, want to find a great story. The kind of story that's sort of above them and is over all the other stories and can help them make sense out of all the rest. And some people think there's no such thing. There's no such thing as one of those stories that's sort of over all the other stories in the world. And then if you think so, that's just sort of a coping mechanism you have to make sense out of meaningless world, meaningless life, kind of driftless existence. That's not what Christians believe. Christians believe that there is a great story, and that the discovering the part that you have to play in the story is sort of what life is all about. fact, in a sense, you want to think about it this way and think about it in Tolkienian terms, helping people find the right story to join and the story to live by. That's what evangelism is. That's trying to open up a book to people so that they'll see themselves in the story and want to join in on it. Then that is the right story. That's the one that I want to be a part of. And here's where we can start talking about Tolkien's work as Christian work, The Lord of the Rings in particular, which I'm mostly focused on actually today and tomorrow, although there are many other sort of deuterocanonical Tolkien things as well, all of which I own.
Me too.
Excellent. Great. We should compare notes. Tolkien said, The Lord of the Rings, of course, is fundamentally religious and Catholic. And it's not just religious, but it's Christian. And he came from a Catholic perspective, which is a striking thing to say. And this comes from a letter he wrote in 53. Because when you read the books, there are no direct references to Christianity by any stretch. There's not even much overt mention of anything that even looks religious in a formal way. But Tolkien was a very devout Christian. And what he did was permeated by the values and ideals of Christian belief, Christian faith. And I think that the main moves of the gospel are also the main moves of The Lord of the Rings. The truths are the same. The virtues are the same. There's a big story. What are you going to do in the face of that big story? You have to empty yourself, and things tend to turn on people's willingness to surrender who they are and to give up themselves for the sake of others. Divine grace has to break in from time to time. Otherwise, things are going to go awry. True community is based on virtues like mercy and forgiveness and hopefulness and the possibility of redemption. The way of the kingdom is not a way by force, but it's a way by invitation and by help and companionship. And the small is often the most impactful. These are just a bunch of things. We'll look at some in more detail today and look at some more tomorrow. But obviously, people love these stories, and that's one of the reasons why you're here. But they don't realize sometimes that much of what appeals to them about these stories are actually features and moves and instincts within the gospel. And Tolkien meant it specifically to be so. It's like he's telling a parable, but he's not using the agrarian imagery of first century Palestine like Jesus would do. He's using the heroic medieval imagery of Northern Europe. But he's wanting to tell the same story that he understands in the gospels. And writers like C.S. Lewis and Tolkien believed that what they were doing was that much more Christian because it wasn't blatantly theological. Because as it happens, God works through incarnation. He incarnates himself in the world. And the gospel is a story. And you can't really convey the truths of the gospel apart from actually talking about the story in story terms. Sometimes we try to boil it down maybe to, you know, strictly ideas or rules or whatever, but at the end of the day, it's a story. And that's one of the reasons why the gospel means so much to us and has such an impact in the way we live. Tolkien is drawing on that for what he does in The Lord of the Rings. And a lot of it is bound up in, here we go, here's the word you've been waiting to find out more about. Okay, people have said, what is this? I don't even know how to pronounce this. Okay, well, it's not a real common word. My children know it. But it's the word catastrophe with a U in front of it. Eucatastrophe. In Greek, a catastrophe is a downturn, usually a sudden turn. We use the word to mean like a disaster, something that happens suddenly and it's really bad. Typical. Well, Tolkien coined this word, and he added the little Greek particle "u" in front of it, and that makes it good. So, this is a bad turn, but it's a good bad turn. And for him, that concept of the eucatastrophe is what makes the gospel work. And it's what makes his stories work. It's all about a good, bad turn. He's got this grand apocalyptic vision, which he's borrowed from Christianity. And Christian apocalyptic, it's all about a story. Christian apocalyptic is what we're talking about, the book of Revelation or any other form of Christian apocalyptic from early Christianity. It's trying to give its people a story, a way of seeing the world, a way of seeing the world that will penetrate the surface level. Saying, okay, I know it looks like Caesar is Lord, but if you have the right eyes to see and you look under the surface, you'll see that Jesus is Lord. And I know the events lately of the world seem to be moving in a particular direction, but if you understand the story that I'm trying to tell you, you'll see that it's actually moving in a different direction. Mm-hmm. And it's moving towards the Lordship of Christ over all things. And Christian apocalyptic's trying to do that. Tolkien's trying to do it with his storytelling as well. And it's not just about escape. It's not just about, well, let's dream of when this will all be set right and we don't have to worry about, you know, this world. We'll just kind of keep thinking about that. And it's not just about an us and them thing either. Because there's a lot of conflict, a lot of battles, you know, in Tolkien, in Christian apocalyptic. But it's not just about we're the good guys, they're the bad guys. It's as simple as that. It's a little deeper than that. But it does believe that the overall ending of this story is going to be good. Along the way, there's a lot of loss and real pain that shouldn't be glossed over. And there are some important things that really are at risk. Tolkien stories are full of that kind of dynamic. Lots of dramatic climaxes. Sometimes epic battle scenes, right? You watch the movies, you might think it's only epic battle scenes, and then that's the whole story. But that's not true. But there are these incredible epic battle scenes. Mm-hmm. And these harrowing conflicts imply some very dark and terrible things. But in that moment, there are these dramatic turns, these redemptive, eucatastrophic occurrences that open up a window on the way the world really is. And he called that a eucatastrophe. This is in 1938. He was in the early stages of writing The Lord of the Rings, and he was doing a lecture up at St. Andrews University in Scotland, and he talked about this concept of a eucatastrophe at length in this lecture. It's the good catastrophe. The sudden, joyous turn. And he's talking about literature here. He's not speaking to a bunch of Christians. He's speaking to a bunch of literary scholars and medievalists. It's not essentially escapist, he says, or fugitive. It is a sudden and miraculous grace. It doesn't deny the existence of discatastrophe. Sorrow, failure, those are real. That's a real part of what has to be taken on board in this. It denies, in the face of much evidence, if you will, universal and final defeat. It's not saying, no, there is no such thing as failure. It's saying that's not the last word. And here's a good, bad turn that will help reinforce your faith in that. And insofar as it does that, he says, it is evangelion, it's gospel, it's good news, giving a fleeting glimpse of joy, joy beyond the walls of this world, poignant as grief. Now, we talked about there being lots of different stories in the world. And one of the common stories today is kind of a cynical story, a fatalist story. Things are bad, and everything's getting worse, and you can't trust people, and even the good people always let you down. There really are no heroes, and happy endings are not a part of what... surely, if there's some happy ending, that just means somebody else got ripped off, you know? And so there are no real happy endings in the world. And sometimes when Christians respond to that with a kind of easy triumphalism, like we're saying, hey, join us, you know, we're the winners. Everything's fine over here in our place. We don't have any problems. God took all those problems, and so we don't have anything to worry about. It's not convincing to some people who just don't see this clear-cut, happy-ending, easy, quick mentality. and that doesn't seem willing really to sort of grapple with the true pain that is present in the world and the real sense of loss and risk, and that there are things gone bad that must be lamented and they can't just be whitewashed and painted over. They want to believe in hope, I think, but when the hope is too glib or it's too simple or too satisfied in its own comfort, it doesn't seem very real. Or, and this is another tack that sometimes you see in the Christian community, when they're not willing to see their own weaknesses and their own complicity in the darker parts of the story. You know, oh no, that's just what the people out there do, but we're the good guys in the white hats all the time. Well, then it just seems downright fake or fraudulent. That version of the gospel that makes too light of evil or is not willing to say, actually, we're part of the problem and we acknowledge that. There are a lot of people that are just do not respond to that take on the gospel. And at this point in the early years of the 21st century, there are a lot of people, including many of our younger people raised even in our own churches. For Tolkien, the gospel's not quite so glib and easy, and you see this in the stories. What if it's not so simple and so easy to sort of slice and dice and cut and dry? What if the gospel is a hopeful story, but it's also a story of catastrophe? What if it's a story that does give you a real sense of triumph, but it also confronts you with colossal failure and makes you come to grips with that? What if the true story of our world has a happy ending, but it's not a quick and easy ending, a painless ending? For Tolkien, that's the story of the gospel, as well as the story he was trying to write. And so this comes from that same lecture. He's speaking to medievalists and literary scholars in St. Andrews, and he compares it to the story of the Christian gospel. And he believed that one of the reasons that this kind of story, the story that turns on a huge catastrophe, hooks people, is because it strikes this chord of genuine hope deep down that's there, that's waiting, that's listening, that's eager, that's attentive, that really wants and needs to catch a sense of that. And then sometimes it hears various sort of quick and easy and fraudulent and fake versions of that, and that could be titillating for a short time, but they always fall short. You turn on the news or something else happens in your life and you realize, oh, that didn't really do it for me. That was just a quick fix. I need to hear a story about the joy that can happen within lament. Well, Tolkien believed that there was this deep truth in the foundations of the world, just kind of a New Testament idea, that through the death of the Son of God, the deep longings of human beings to find a place and to be one with God and to understand who they were had been satisfied. And that happened within a story that tells us who we are and why existence and why evil, and struggles a bit with all of that and addresses real human suffering. It involves our own searching. It involves our own struggling. But it always turns on a moment of divine grace that we weren't responsible for. And the story gets resolved, not because of something we did, but because God breaks in and does something. So to him, the gospel is eucatastrophe. The tragedy of the human story, the trauma of life in the world, turns at the birth of Jesus Christ. That's a eucatastrophic moment in the story. Then there's the story of the incarnation, and it gets pinned down by the tragedy of Jesus' rejection by people and his death on the cross. But that turns by divine grace in the eucatastrophe of the resurrection. Tolkien believed that the great stories tap into that story. They tap into that myth. Myth, not in the sense of something made up, but in the sense of a story that tells you the truth about the way things are. And that the great stories tap into that. And that's one of the reasons why we resonate so much with them. We love them because they give us a sudden glimpse of the underlying reality or truth or the good news. And it was actually this line of thinking on an evening in September of 1931, after dinner in the Magdalen College Gardens in Oxford, Tolkien and Lewis are walking through the gardens with Hugo Dyson talking about faith. Lewis has kind of decided he believes in God again, but that's about as far as he can go. And Tolkien talked about how the Gospel of Jesus, the significance of it, is that it is the perfect myth. It's a powerful story that's right and true and guiding and governing. It tells the deep truth of who we are, but it's perfect because it's not just a story of words. It's a real person who came into the world as part of the history of Israel and whose story has been told and attested to in poetry and narrative, i.e. the Bible, story, the Christian tradition, down through the centuries. And that was compelling to C.S. Lewis. And a few days after that conversation, he decided to become a Christian. Now, the two of them committed themselves to writing these kind of stories, stories that would tap into that great story and find ways to talk about the truth of this in their own world, really coming to grips with the real issues in the real world of the middle of the 20th century. And so, you know, famously, Lewis writes Chronicles of Narnia and the Space Trilogy. Those are probably the two best examples of this from Lewis's work. Now, those are great stories. They have so many overtly Christian pieces that a lot of times non-Christians are a little standoffish about it. You know, it's like, okay, is this Christian propaganda or something? But in The Lord of the Rings, the gospel is so deep, people fall in love with it without knowing they're actually falling in love with the story of Jesus. But they need someone to sort of come alongside and help them see that. I don't know what it is you've heard, maybe even from some of us in our preaching, but this actually is the story of Jesus and what it's all about. So, in our last several minutes, what are some of the key features of this eucatastrophic tale that make it promising, points of conversation that make this a promising story when talking with people about the gospel today? Well, we've already hit on one. It has to do with the fact that this is a story. We're part of the story, and it's a big story. It's a story that's big enough to call you out of your self-obsession to something bigger than you. A big cause, a big purpose, a big meaning, and boy, we need that. We need to be called outside of ourselves. But it's also a story intimate enough to be about you, to have a place for you. That you're involved in the story really matters to the story. Again, life is very much about finding the right story to live by and then learning how to live by that story. Another feature has to do with evil. In this story, evil is very real. And the movies have no problem depicting this graphically, but if you're Peter Jackson, you sort of cut your teeth in the film industry making zombie movies. The other films you're going to make are going to be pretty graphic too, right? But the story has a lot of hard-hitting images just in the narrative alone. There's a lot of darkness in the world. There are a lot of scary things in the world. And if you unmask them and see them for what they are, they're pretty frightening. And that needs to be a real part of how the story gets told. The gospel's pretty honest with that, too. Jesus goes around in his ministry confronting all kinds of evil. And it's not just people whose lives are under the thrall of the powers of evil. It's casting out demons and darkness. It's all the other kinds of issues that he's wrestling with in people's lives. Their addictions, their misplaced loyalties, their anxieties, their complicity in power structures that create great wealth for some and poverty and suffering for others. And he's confronting these all the time, trying to unmask them for what they are. Or if you think about getting into the Apostle Paul's heart as he's trying to grapple with the impact of people's actions that are sort of ripping apart communities of faith. Or he's trying to help people deal with some of their addictions to social values. This is a story that acknowledges the reality of evil and doesn't want to be sort of Pollyanna about that or simplistic about that. But it can also be very complicated, especially for people who are tempted to oversimplify things. Maybe oversimplifying it into an us-them. We're the good ones, they're the evil ones. Or oversimplifying evil into a certain kind of evil. Well, it's just about what's in your heart. It's not about what's out here in society. Those are oversimplifications.
Just let it go!
Scenes a lot of people do not like.
Yeah.
Not just because, you know, everybody's sweaty, but because of kind of how it moves in the narrative. The scene here at Samoth Nahr, the cracks of doom. In quest stories, the hero is supposed to get the job done at the end. That's what's supposed to happen. They go along, they learn. They have to learn and grow and develop their capacities and learn courage and certain skills, and they have to trust people and all that. But the whole point of that journey is to get to the point where you finally get there, and you've done all this traveling, and you've had all these good days and bad days, and you've had all this help, and you've learned all these things, and frankly, all you have to do is chuck it in that you do it. And that's not this story. And this is right before the ultimate eucatastrophic moment in the tale. Tolkien said, as he was responding to someone who wrote to him, people would write letters, and he would write letters back, and there are a lot of letters preserved from his correspondence. And people would complain about this. This just is not right. I mean, what's the whole point of this journey if Frodo can't even... I thought he was one of the good guys and all that. Wasn't he poised and ready? And of course, you know, the ring does actually get destroyed, right? But how does that happen? Yeah, Gollum jumps him and takes the ring, and he's not watching very well, and he kind of slips. And you're going, wow, that's not very satisfying. So is Tolkien just a bad storyteller? Well, possibly. It seems unlikely. He said in one of his letters, in response to somebody who said, "What's the deal?" said, the scene at the Samoth Nahr is a fairy story exemplum on the Lord's Prayer. And especially this last part of the Lord's Prayer. Lead us not into temptation, but deliver us from evil. What does this mean? Mm-hmm. Exactly. A lot of people pray this prayer all the time. What in the world are they saying at this point? Mm-hmm. The first part makes it sound as though God could possibly be responsible for some of the bad things. But the last part makes it sound as though evil is something that is something else and that he might rescue us from. It's as if there really is this power beyond our power. Sure, sometimes evil seems like a choice. Sometimes it seems like a force, which is something bigger than us and beyond us. And evil's tough, and sin is difficult. So, as Christians, we have this tendency to oversimplify it, too. Sometimes treating evil as if it's very easy to define. You know, it's easy to identify, it's easy to name, and usually, preferably, it's out there. You know, it's the evil out there, away from us, it's not in my life, it's not in my heart, it's certainly not in my church. Christians don't do evil, even what the non-Christians do. They're the enemy, we're not. Tolkien knew that in true biblical Christian theology, evil's not so easy to figure out. It is not so cut and dried. And I think his way of presenting it, in a lot of ways, has been more true to people's experience of it, especially as we reflect on the great evils of our world and our time. For one thing, when you look at the things that God actually cares about that keep coming up over and over again in the Gospels and in Scripture, it's as much about feeding the poor and dealing with greed or kind of managing interpersonal conflict as it is maybe about personal sexual ethics or whether I can practice my religion in public places. You realize that in Scripture, evil is out there and evil is in here. And it's maybe both. And as much as we want to rely on our own powers to fix the world's problems and our own problems, we can't. Some evil is just too big for us. And this is what Tolkien said about this scene, which is the hinge point of the climax. Frodo failed. I'm not pretending he didn't. Mm-hmm. But one must face the fact the power of evil in the world is not finally resistible by incarnate creatures. However, good. And, this is a nice addendum, and the writer of the story is not us. So there might be lots of ways that I might prefer to end the story or something, but I'm sort of locked in by what the gospel says about the way things are. And one of the things the gospel says about the way things are is that evil is partly about a force that you can't control and can't manage on your own. Now, today, some people want to believe we can make things work. We just try hard enough and just figure it out. Just get enough education, put in the right funding to the right agencies. We can organize solutions to the problems and fix the world. Others, are totally pessimistic about that. They see we've been trying that all 20th century, and we're just completely self-destructive, and there's really no hope whatsoever. Tolkien believes that for all the 20th century human experiments to save ourselves, the vaccines and the machines and the technology, the force of war for the sake of justice, economic experience like communism and free market, fascism, democracy, and now he probably talked about genetics and nanotechnology, religious movements with all the things that they might claim, we still cannot save ourselves. And one of the great truths of humanity is that we need a divine grace breaking in. We know deep down that we need a story that turns on a eucatastrophe. There's no doubt there's a catastrophe. We're in the middle of it. But we need a story that turns on a eucatastrophe and desperately want to believe that that is the real story, that that's a true story. The ring incarnates evil, but it's tricky. Have you noticed, with the ring in the story, it's hard to tell whether the danger is coming from inside or from outside. Is it a temptation? Is it about wrong desires and therefore personal sin? Or is there something going on that comes in on me from outside, a power that's pushing me? This is very strong in the books, but it even shows up in the films, too. And a lot of people have noticed that in many ways the ring functions like an addiction in the story, and all of that is a kind of a 20th century insight to how human behavior works, how addiction, that's a category that really resonates with us because it helps us make sense out of things that are happening to us in our lives. Where these elements of both sides, it's partly about the choices I'm making, it's partly about forces that I cannot control that are bigger than myself. And that may not seem fair, but it's completely true to life. And the way Tolkien deals with this evil, I think is very true to our modern experience. Do the evils of our world, evils like poverty and oppression and entrapment to sinful and self-destructive habits and behaviors and abuse, do those things exist because people are making stupid choices? Or do those things exist because of social structures that are making it difficult for others to make certain kinds of choices? And Tolkien, having heard any number of answers to that question, is saying, well, the gospel says yes. The gospel says, yeah, it's kind of a both and on that deal. If I use the ring, is it because I've given in to my desire? Or is it because I've been overwhelmed by something that I couldn't have controlled anyway? Tolkien's story leaves you wrestling with a both and. And again, in a way that's really frustrating for a lot of people. I'll show you another clip.
But something happened then the ring did not intend. It was picked up by the most unlikely creature imaginable. A hobbit, Bilbo Baggins of the Shire.
A ring.
I wish the ring had never come to me. I wish none of this had happened.
So do all who live to see such times, but that is not for them to decide. All we have to decide is what to do with the time that is given to us. There are other forces at work in this world, Frodo, besides the will of evil. Bilbo was meant to find the ring, in which case you also were meant to have it. And that is an encouraging thought.
This both and take on evil that Tolkien pushes, tries to see it in all its forms. It doesn't want to let anybody off the hook, you know, with the struggle. But one of the key elements in the story, and the one I want to close with today, is that there are other forces at work besides the will of evil. Because you're in a story, and there is an author. And therefore, things are not meaningless, and they are moving in a particular direction. There's a good purpose, and it's moving towards a final consummation. Not everything in the world's wrong. Not everything is dark. There are other forces at work. And like Sam said, we struggle to find our place in the story. But there is this story. And it's moving towards this final U catastrophe. But along the way, and this is true in the Lord of the Rings as well, along the way there are all these smaller U catastrophes. These risky, and defiance of death is like one of the big ones for Tolkien. Bilbo is presumed dead in Hobbit multiple times. Frodo is presumed dead at least 6 times in The Lord of the Rings. Even Bill the Pony is thought to be dead. Then he comes back. This is a huge one. It shows up over and over again in The Lord of the Rings. Gandalf, of course, famously. That there is resurrection. And it's not just final resurrection, but smaller resurrections along the way. And those pull back the curtains on the way the world really is. And give you a sense of what's really moving under the surface, despite what seems to be happening. I mean, it's really happening underneath the surface, despite what seems to be happening sort of on the surface, superficial level. So people who like this story, what they're actually appreciating is the apocalyptic story of Jesus Christ. Maybe without knowing it. So that's very sneaky. It's possibly unethical. But I do like it. Sometimes I think the story of Jesus needs some different clothes than we're used to, or maybe then have been sort of overridden by particular religious groups that have their own way of always telling the story to see it fresh for what it is. And I think there are many presentations of the Christian gospel that don't do nearly as good a job of helping people see why the story of Jesus is a story that works today. So, now we know what a eucatastrophe is and how it connects to the gospel, and you can pronounce it at least. If nothing else, you were able to walk out of here and say, it's not a me catastrophe, it's a eucatastrophe. But tomorrow, if you want to come back, both of you, we'll look at some of the practical details that fit into this story. We'll talk a little bit about the ring, about whether or not you've been trying to use it and how that would not be recommended, actually. We're going to talk a little bit about nature and technology, about how a group forms real community around practices of the cross. We're going to talk about fellowship and how small might be better. And I hope that as we look at those themes tomorrow, they'll give us some talking points with people who, in this, you know, sneaky, underhanded way, have actually come to appreciate what the gospel is trying to say about the world and life and salvation and everything, but may not know it. Thanks for being here today. I hope you have a great rest of the day.